Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Michael Simshauser, and we are going to be talking about The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick, which won the 1963 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Michael, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for inviting me, Seth.
Yeah, it's funny because I think I must have reached out to you really early on, and you put your name down for this book, and then I completely forgot. And at some point, I was looking at the list on my website and saw that Man in the High Castle was in italics. So I knew that somebody had claimed it. And I'm like, who claimed that one? Who claimed that one? And had to go dig back through my email and find out that, oh, my buddy Michael. So sorry about that. But this has allowed me to, kind of learn what I'm doing for this most important episode with my most important listener, Michael.
I need to put that on a business card, don't I?
Yes. The Hugo's There podcast, most important listener. So, Michael, why don't you talk about yourself
a bit? I live in Australia, and I've pretty much been a science fiction fan most of my life. I think it was just a confluence of my mother growing up on Doctor Who, dad having an interest in science, and just being born at the right time, I guess, a year before Star Wars, which I know isn't really technically science fiction, it's more space opera, but all the other stuff that came out at that time just really engaged what I was interested in. I think it was inevitable, but... And then when I started reading, I just sort of gravitated more towards science fiction and the stuff I was watching on TV and at the movies and that sort of thing. So, yeah, that's pretty much my history in science fiction in about 30 seconds. But
nice.
High school was probably more the time that I was a bit of a it's probably hard to believe now, but I was a bit of a introvert, so I was more hiding in the library sort of thing, reading a lot, and devoured high school's science fiction books, just read a lot of them, but yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I think that's kind of a common story with nerdy types sometimes, that books and, you know, science fiction and role-playing games and all that kind of stuff become the place you go when hanging out with people in the real world is not working out. But it's not always that way. And then I guess in terms of the history of us being friends kind of comes from Take Me to Your Reader, where you found us, I think, through another podcast and were one of our kind of early and frequent commenters, which we always really appreciated. So thank you for that.
That's all right. Science Fiction Movie Podcast, which I think is now defunct. But, I was an early adopter. I think you guys just basically were in my wheelhouse, which was, we're going to do a podcast on science fiction movies that have been adapted from science fiction books. And I think I couldn't find the sign-up sheet quick enough.
Cool. Well, so kind of moving in to talk about this book a little bit, what is it about this book? Why was this the one that you chose?
I've always liked alternative history and that sort of thing. Just to give you a bit of personal background, my parents divorced when I was about 8. So having something like that happen at such a young age and always wondering what would have happened had that decision that was out of my control been different or had gone a different way, the idea of alternate history just sort of and alternate dimensions always appealed to me. And just the way that through just a fickle bit of fate, things can just change. The one that really resonated with me reading this was, I don't know if you know of James Packer, that was married to Mariah Carey very, very briefly. He's a big magnate down here, and he comes from a very rich family, and his grandfather basically was living in Tasmania, so the remotest island that is part of Australia, the most remote part of Australia. And the thing that kicked off the whole empire was that he had a bet on a horse race in Tasmania that had 12-1 odds, and it was when he won the money from that horse race that allowed him to go to the mainland, which allowed him to get into newspapers, which allowed him to buy newspapers, which is, you know, eventually all leads to,
right,
you know, his grandson, you know, being in a position where he can marry Mariah Carey. So just that whole thing, hedging off that one decision, if that one horse race, if the horse had thrown a shoe, history would have been completely different.
Yeah.
So that's what always appeals to me about alternate histories and what ifs. I read a lot of What If and Elseworlds. For those that don't know, What If was a Marvel comic book series that basically dealt with things that happened in the Marvel Universe, but if they'd happened differently. And right. Elseworlds, being a DC guy, you've probably read a lot of Elseworlds, but same sort mm-hmm. of thing, but with Batman and Superman and whatnot.
Nice. Are you a big Philip K. Dick fan, or is this kind of, you know, the only thing of his that you like?
I've got to confess, I've probably watched more movies based on his works than I have read the books.
Okay.
I recently, yesterday, I picked up a copy of Minority Report for $2 at a bookstore, sale, so I was pretty happy about that. But I've always enjoyed the movies that that his books have been based on. I think I'm starting with Blade Runner, Total Recall, not the remake. I refuse to watch the remake. and some of the other ones like Paycheck. And I'm trying to think of the other one. The one with Gary Sinise wasn't
Imposter.
Great. Imposter. Yeah. Screamers. I mean, I don't think you can really sort of – I think he's probably one of the most adapted authors I can think of that has had so much of his stuff done to, and with such varying degrees of success as well. But I'd have to say I'm looking forward to reading the book of the one with Keanu Reeves, Scanner Darkly, because I thought that was that was haven't read a little bit about who Philip K. Dick was. It seems like the most the book that is most close to what he was actually like, rather than him writing about what he was writing about. It just seems more in his sort of more autobiographical, I think, especially with the quote they use at the end about people that he had known who were experimenting, and unfortunately, you know, those experimentations led to them either being psychotic or dead, and sort of being nice to them and saying, well, look, okay, the things they were doing were probably illegal, but you know, we're all experiencing or experimenting with the human experience. Why can't we just let people do that and just so Scanner Darkly, and that's pretty much it. Is but Man in the High Castle is probably my first one I've read entirely through.
Nice. I think the only one other one of his novels that I've read all the way through is Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? But really, for me, I like him better in short fiction. So I'm not as attracted to his novels, but this is one that I've read. I think I read this one a couple years ago when the show was coming out, and I wanted to kind of just be aware of what it was about before the show showed up. So can you give kind of a, I'm not even sure it's possible to do any sort of non-spoiler synopsis of this book, but, you know, as non-spoiler as possible.
I could make a very short non-spoilery one. What if the Japanese and the Germans or the Axis powers had won World War II? I think that's about as non-spoilery.
This is an interesting one because something that I like about the book is that it doesn't really go into a lot of the hows and whys of the defeat of the Allies. It mentions a couple things in passing, like there was an assassination that was not successful in our world, but was in the world of the book. And then, you know, a succession of presidents that had different policies on entering or not entering World War II and all the effect that had, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah, it felt like a really fully realized world to me. It was like having a glimpse into it, which I think was what he was trying to do. But things that were just said, they were said in such a way that they were just accepted. This is the way that we do things here. So I know that both of us, being from different countries, there is that sort of cultural divide where some things you just go, okay, well, that's what they do there. And you eventually get the context, and basically then it leads to sort of the understanding of it, which that's what I felt reading the book was we just got dropped in the middle of it. It doesn't happen. For example, there's a similar book called and the TV show SSGB, which is basically if the Germans invaded England. And I think from what I can gather, that sort of just happens not long after, whereas I think the smart thing that Philip K. Dick did was to set it that length of time later. So it gives it time to sort of change the society and change the way things are done and that sort of thing. So I think that was a really, really smart move that he did in doing that. But
so is this a reread for you or a first-time read?
First time.
Okay. So this is, you signed up for this one because it's one that you wanted to get to.
Yes.
Okay, nice. So like I mentioned, it's a reread for me and kind of by way of overall thoughts. On a first read, I wasn't really sure what to make of the book because it's definitely not plot heavy. Mm-hmm. It's more kind of philosophical in a lot of ways and there's things that happen in the book, but there's not like one character that you follow all the way through. It's kind of parallel narratives of several characters that in some cases don't even intersect. But I feel like the second time through, I got it a little more, but even so it took probably, I don't know, 80% of the reread for me to get to something that I'm like, okay, that's something I can grab onto. And we'll get into that more in the spoiler discussion. What was your impression of this one though?
I really liked how it was, for lack of want of a better term, it was almost like a book version of Inception, where you had the book within the book.
Right.
And not only that, but the fact that, that, like you said, there was all those sort of plot threads, but they didn't completely come together, but it was there was still that sense of interconnectedness of it, that that character knows this character and he's, you know, unknowingly influencing that, which when we get into the spoiler discussion, I suppose I can say a bit more about their whole decision-making process and how that affects the plot and things that the characters do that affect the plot as well, because I think that's a part of it as well, is that the way they make the decisions, the way that they seem to make the decisions, and also the way that Philip K. Dick, also in reading about how he wrote the book, how he made decisions about it as well.
Right. Yeah, we can maybe get into some of that as well. So who would you recommend this novel to, like fans of other properties? Who, you know, how would you recommend it?
I would recommend it to people that enjoy Philip K. Dick's style of writing and also that sort of paranoia sort of thing that he is really, really good at. This the way that you think that the reality is the reality until he goes no and just pulls the rug out from underneath you, sort of thing. Anyone that likes alternate history or a fan of history and that sort of thing, that's pretty much who I'd recommend it to. It's not a huge book, so it's not like a it's not a difficult read. And like you said, it wasn't very plot heavy. So anyone that just wants something relatively light, interesting, and I'd say not hugely thought-provoking. It does sort of ask some questions, but I think if you're in the right frame of mind, you'll definitely have a think about what they're actually saying as well. And
I think some people would find the book frustrating in that it doesn't necessarily come right out and say, here's the theme of this book and we're going to bash you over the head with it. And here's what the book means. And, you know, in some senses I get that because I like books that are clear sometimes, but I also like ones that just kind of give me a framework to think about and kind of have me scratching my head going, Now, what happened in this book, you know, or what was this about? And just leads me to kind of deeper contemplation of it without necessarily hitting me over the head with it's this thing, you know, and kind of stifling my own creative thought about the book that I'm reading.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Because I sort of, I'm probably the flip side of your view on it, which is good. And it's great because it means we're having a discussion now about it. But things like that, like 2001, A Space Odyssey, where it's not completely clear and it's open to interpretation, and both of us may go away and read an article on another person's view on it. It won't necessarily change our view, but it just opens up different avenues, which I probably find that part of it really appealing, that I might have one view on it when we get into the spoiler discussion and yours might be completely different, which is which is great.
It almost makes me want to go off on my rant that I'm always talking with Colin about. I'm not sure how much we've talked about it on Take Me to Your Reader, but just the kind of the whole death of the author philosophy that, like, I don't like when a writer comes out and confirms a fan theory or says, this is what that thing means. Because I feel like once the book's out there, let people have their opinions of it and don't tell them that that opinion is wrong or and that one is right. Just, you know, allow there to be that breadth of interpretation for something rather than just locking it down.
Because what was it Arthur C. Clarke said when 2001 came out? If you understand it, then we've failed. And that's the sort of the tenet that I work on, is that if I understand a piece of art completely, then it's either too, and this is nothing against the artist in any way, shape or form, but it's too simple. It's been too obvious. I think a good piece of art, you should be able to look at it at several different times within your own lifetime.
Right.
And it means something different each time. The best example I can think of with that is maybe listening to something like Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. The themes in that album would mean something different to me now than they did when I was 30 and when I was 20. You know, different things would resonate, different things would be important, and different things would mean different things during that. So
yeah,
that's what I'm sort of, I enjoy art like that. I don't feel, I know some people probably feel, for lack of want of a better term, stupid by it, but to me that's wrong as well, because no matter how you feel about it, as long as you can articulate how you feel about it, then that's valid as well.
Well, or even just being honest and saying, I don't get it, you know, and that's fine. Mm. But I don't think a lot of people are comfortable necessarily. Not everybody's comfortable with saying, I don't get that and I'm okay with it.
Mm. That's true.
Yeah. Hey, I think we should just go ahead and get into spoilers and we can talk about whatever we want to.
Sound good? Yep, sounds good.
Cool. Kind of anything that you want to talk about. I've got a couple things written down, but wherever you want to take it.
Okay. I really thought that the use of the I Ching in the book was really, really, really interesting. The fact that not only were the characters sort of giving up their free will, they were always, I'll go back to the I Ching and confirm. And it was like, I don't want to sound horrible against people that believe in horoscopes.
Right.
But it was very similar to that it was something that was very, I'll consult that and I'll make my decision based on that, which, and to me, the fact that also, I don't know if you read that Philip K. Dick also, like the author of the Grasshopper Lays Heavy, also consulted the I Ching. So that's what I sort of mean by the whole meta thing, that when Abinson reveals to Juliana at the end of the book that basically he's been consulting the I Ching to write the Grasshopper Lays Heavy, and that's what he defines as what the truth is. It's like they're basically saying that, you know, there is no free will. It doesn't matter what you consult the I Ching on, it'll just come out whatever way it's going to come out anyway, which to me doesn't sort of gel with how you make a decision, and we've all made thousands of decisions throughout our lifetimes. We make the decision we make at the time that we've got the best information that we have at hand. And I think when they're making those calls back to the I Ching. It's like they're devolving that responsibility back to something else to say, well, I made the wrong decision, but the I Ching said this, and that meant right. I had to do this, rather than going, well, I've got my own free will. I should make the decision based on what I want or what the right information is at the time. So I thought that was really yeah. interesting that not only did the characters do it, and it was a Chinese influence, not a Japanese influence, which
yeah,
I found interesting as well. And that, yeah, so it was basically that they would just devolve that, and it didn't, it crossed all the sort of cultural strata as well. So everyone from Frank Frink that worked in a metal shop all the way up to the high Japanese officials, everyone sort of consulted it. And that also, I think, adds to the thing we were discussing before, where we're sort of trapped right in the middle of it. And it's so many of the Americans in the Japanese states have already picked up all of those cultural things that the Japanese and Japanese states
yeah.
have picked up, and all the ones in the Nazi-occupied states have picked up. It seems like the only ones that are like, quote-unquote, real Americans are the ones in Colorado that are relatively right. free.
Yeah, in the neutral territories. Ooh. I thought this time that particularly in talking about that kind of meta thing of ooh. Dick uses the I Ching to decide some courses of the plot of the book. The characters ooh. In the book decide the course of what happens or what they do. And then the author, Abinson, uses it to write this other book about a different history. Ooh. Kind of that meta thing of this is what alternate history is, right? It's the rolling of dice and deciding that, you know, something happens at maybe six different points, or depending on, you know, when they're using those stocks that they use. I'm sure it's much, much more complex than just rolling a six-sided die.
Yeah.
But it made me kind of think of, is the universe of this book like a simulated universe? Because that's what it made me think of. Like, the universe in this book is running on a computer somewhere, and each of the characters has their own little decision-making matrix, but it's not really in their hands, right? It's kind of random. It's done by computer. And I know it's not really that, but that's what kind of I was thinking of it as. Everybody in the book is sort of non-player characters in a role-playing game or something, and the computer is rolling the dice for them and deciding what to do.
Okay, that's an interesting take on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I just because my view would be a little bit different, but I think it was mainly because we only really ever saw characters that were in either of those sort of states. We didn't see anyone. Oh, we saw a few people in Colorado, but I don't think we, like you were saying, that wasn't really fleshed out as to how they act or think or how they decision make as well. It's probably something yeah. that is probably covered in the TV show, but it definitely wasn't an expanded on in the TV show, but it just wasn't yeah. something that was covered in the book, whether that was by design or not.
The other thing that I kind of thought of when they're consulting they call it the Oracle, ooh. Right, is how much of it are they really letting the Oracle decide versus bringing confirmation bias to what they see, because ooh. When you actually look, because he'll show you, you know, this is what I rolled for this, and this is the passage. And there were a few times where I looked at those things, I'm like, well, that's a really ambiguous statement. And you can kind ooh. Of read it, if you're looking for a positive confirmation or a negative confirmation, you can kind of read it either direction.
Yeah. I suppose that's what made me think of horoscopes, because,
right.
Yeah. A lot of people, and yeah, more power to them if that's what they believe in, but, that something vague and non-descriptive can influence their life at that point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's the sort of thing I took away from it, was that it was more yeah. I sort of looked at it as a lot more people just reading like their horoscopes and being guided by that, but also, like you were saying, taking cherry picking what they yeah. wanted to be right about the decision they made, rather than just, you know, let the chips fall where they may, and just saying, well, this is what I'm going to do, and I've got to rough idea of what the consequences are going to be. It just also felt like it was a I don't think they really blamed the Oracle if it was wrong, but I think they probably blamed themselves more. I must have read it wrong, or I must have done something wrong, or I should have consulted it earlier or later. But at no point they sort of say responsible for their decisions, which
There's more expression of regret that they, you know, for when they didn't consult it, because maybe they would have had a clearer path, right?
Yeah.
Hey, let's do a rundown of the kind of the narratives in this book, for because I know there's people who listen to the podcast regardless of if they've actually read the book.
Yeah.
So what we have is we have Robert Childen, who is a salesman. Really, he runs a shop where he sells, I can't remember what it is, you know, genuine American
antiquities.
Yeah, antiquities. That's right. And then there's Juliana. Well, I guess we should probably start with Frank, right? Frank, like you mentioned, he works in a metal shop and he's Jewish, but he's hiding it. And that's a really dangerous thing to be in a Axis occupied US. And he's in the Pacific States. Is that right?
That's why he freaks out a bit, I think, when he gets arrested later in the book, because they find out that he is Jewish and that they want to extradite him back to the Nazi occupied ones. And the whole process of that, that felt very, very real. That they would just sort of pick him up because of his Jewishness, and the way they were sort of acting was like they were literally going to make him disappear, which I'd love to be able to say is not appropriate in this day and age, but unfortunately it is.
Yeah. Yeah. So then there's Juliana, his ex-wife, and she is in the neutral territories and comes across the Grasshopper Lies Heavy, the novel, and reads it and wants to go meet the author of it. And unbeknownst to her, her kind of boyfriend at the time also wants to go see him, but he wants to go see him because he's an agent of the German side and wants to assassinate him. And then there's Mr. Tagomi, who is kind of high up in the trade ministry. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe it's a trade ministry.
And I'm trying to think if, are there any other point of view characters that we get?
Not really. I don't think.
I guess we get Wegener, right? Mr. Baines, who's coming to see Mr. Tagomi. I thought that Mr. Childen is an interesting character because he is kind of the, like a collaborator in a lot of ways. And that's like you said, one thing that's interesting about the book is that it doesn't take place right after World War II. It's almost a generation later where people have just kind of accepted the new status quo, where Childen knows that he's a second-class citizen because he's not Japanese, but he's also kind of a petty climber, and he wants to find as many ways to put himself above other people as he can. And so he even thinks of the person running his pedicab when he has to go someplace. He thinks of him as a racial epithet, right? Because he's Chinese, and he wants to find a black person to carry his things, and, you know, think of him as a slave. And it's like he's the kind of person who wants to make himself taller by making other people shorter. And he has this veneer of respect for the Japanese and admiration for them. But as soon as something sours in the relationship between him and this young Japanese family, like his inner racist just bursts out.
Yeah.
So he was a complicated guy.
Oh, very. And I think the writing of it also, I don't know if it was more commonplace when Philip K. Dick wrote it, or whether it's just we're seeing it through our eyes now looking back. But all the sort of racial epithets that stand out, the way that there's no sort of, it's either all or nothing. It's either Children either respects them, or even the worst racial epithet you can. And that happens for other races as well. I wouldn't say it was confronting, but it was, like you said, it was a very thin veneer of almost eggshell-like, that he looked fine from the outside, but just the slightest crack and then everything would sort of come spilling out. Mm-hmm. I found that really interesting, the way that was written, that all civility and knowing the customs of the Japanese and being able to interact in those worlds, but still underneath that being resentful of them as well.
Yeah. Other topics you want to talk about?
I'm interested to see what the TV show is like in comparison to the book, simply because now that it's been revealed that the fourth season will be the last, it'll be interesting to see how they sort of, whether they go as in-depth into those sort of themes that we've been discussing, or whether they'll turn more to the whole alternate history angle of it, which I think if they do that, it's possibly a little bit of a shame, because I think the themes that we've been talking about are probably more interesting than just exploring a world where these other things happen. I think that's sort of the interesting thing about it, and about, I think, from what I've seen of Dick's adaptions, that you think it's about one thing, but it's about something else entirely different. That's what I hope that the TV show sort of, but it is what it is as well, I imagine. So, but and it just there wasn't very much. I think from memory, there I know that some of his later books, like Scanner Darkly, there's a lot more drug use, and it just seems to not. There's no sort of real use of that in this book. I don't know whether it's the culture he describes, or whether it hadn't influenced him at that point.
Yeah, maybe not. There's a couple references to marijuana cigarettes.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
Which I think were pretty prevalent in the 50s, probably here as well. But, I didn't mind the book. I found it an interesting read, simply because of what you were saying before, where it was there wasn't like a huge galaxy-rending plot that drove the entire story forward, but it was more like a glimpse of into a different world. And also when they're reading The Grasshopper Lays Heavy, it's almost a glimpse of a glimpse. Of a world that they think is the correct one, but there's little things in it that sort of go, well, hang on, that never happened. So, it was just really interesting. And then to take that step back again, so seeing, like we were discussing before, about Amundsen using the I Ching to do the plot, and the people that read the book, like Juliana, thinking that Amundsen has all the answers, and then pulling back again, it's almost like one of those pictures of the artist painting a picture. Going back to where you've got Philip K. Dick, and you read the book not knowing that he used I Ching, like you were saying, to develop the plot points, but then realizing that him himself doesn't have any answers, and he's consulting something else to get that information as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that's, I think, the most interesting thing, is the fact that it's so meta is probably about the best way to describe it, that at no point, all three levels of reality in this book, that no one really has any sort of definitive answers for anything.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, I thought that was fascinating too. The when she's talking to Amundsen at the end, and they consult the Oracle and find that the book is true, that the Germans really did lose World War II. And I don't really have any idea what that means, right? What does true even mean in the context of this novel?
I sort of perceived that was that that what they were looking at doing with the Germans attacking the Japanese and getting rid of them, that they had only, quote-unquote, tolerated them for the intervening years from when the end of World War II until the point the novel starts, just sort of says to me that the Germans lost, as in they're going to homogenize the entire Earth. They're talking about going to Mars, and it'll just be that homogenous German culture, which I know sounds incredibly funny coming from someone that has a German surname, but I do. But that's what I believe, is that they've lost, because I think the greatest things about society in general is the whole cultural melting pot, that we don't have to sort of stay within what extremely racist people would believe is our sort of little cultural cul-de-sac, that I should only, you know, listen to European music or to, you know, to Australian stories or to British things or to things that are predominantly white Anglo-Saxon, that things like anime and Japanese movies and Icelandic crime dramas should be not open to me. Yeah, so I think any society that sort of homogenizes like that has lost.
Right.
I think that's also a thing that I found interesting as well, that the Japanese culture seemed more willing to take things from other cultures, the way that his hosts, when children takes the items to the house and the Japanese wife cooks him a steak.
Right, and plays jazz, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and tries to make him the fact of the I Ching actually being in it because that's a Chinese thing. Whereas the German stuff was all very rigid. Even Juliana's boyfriend Joe says that we never get to listen to Puccini or any of the Italian composers or anything. It's always the polkas and the German stuff, which, you know, says to me that, and the way that the Germans, you know, want to betray the Japanese and also don't treat their allies very well, it just goes, you know, to show me that that is what their ultimate plan is that they don't trust anyone but themselves, and they will lose because they've lost all that diversity.
I like it. So you kind of alluded to it. Oh, you didn't allude to it. You directly referenced the plot of the Germans, right? The Operation Dandelion, where, and this is kind of the most plot heavy thing in the book, that there is an attempt by someone in the German hierarchy to come over and tell the Japanese to warn them about this plot and to hopefully stave off what's going to happen, because it's going to be an attack on the home islands. So Wegener is that character, right? He's posing as a Swiss guy and coming over, and he wants to meet with Mr. Tagomi and with this other Japanese general.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting that after he delivered the message, then he was content to go back to Germany and accept his fate. You know, not to Germany, but to the Reich states, right? To the East Coast. Or maybe it was Germany. I don't remember. Because there had been a change of leadership in Germany. And he just thought, well, I'm going to go back here. They're going to shoot me. You know, have I done anything that's worthwhile? And I like this. He starts kind of musing on the rocket ship on the way back. And he says, evidently we go on as we always have from day to day. At this moment, we work against Operation Dandelion. Later on, at another moment, we work to defeat the police. But we cannot do it all at once. It is a sequence, an unfolding process. We can only control the end by making a choice at each step. And that very much goes back to the consulting the I Ching, right? Which is almost not making a choice, right? It's almost abrogating the responsibility to make that choice every day. And I like then that he goes on and says, on some other world, possibly it's different. Better. There are clear good and evil alternatives, not these obscure admixtures, these blends with no proper tool by which to untangle the components. We do not have an ideal world such as we would like, where morality is easy because cognition is easy, where one can do right with no effort because he can detect the obvious. And that, to me, was the stuff that stuck out the most on this reading, where that's kind of what alternate history can do for us, right? To make us think, you know, we may think that we're in a bad situation right now. You know, a lot of people in the U.S., for instance, and in the world, you know, think that there's some bad things going on. And we want to look back and go, well, maybe it's better, you know, somewhere else. But it's not necessarily better at every turning point. There's plenty of turning points that could have made things even worse. And so that just kind of got me to thinking about all that stuff.
Yeah, not only that, but I think it also sort of speaks to the need for people in those situations and probably their own situations as well to sometimes you just literally have to make a stand. When you were saying that, I immediately thought of Klaus von Stauffenberg, who was inexplicably played by Tom Cruise in Valkyrie. But, the fact that he sort of saw what was happening as I am a German soldier, I am doing what I'm being ordered to do, but what the higher ups are doing is wrong. So, and he paid the ultimate price for it. Yeah. So, I think the willingness to sort of, make the decision that you don't want to make, but you make anyway. Cause I don't think any of the characters in the book really make a decision where they really sort of put themselves. Oh, no, that's not entirely true. Juliana makes a decision to kill Joe and not go back.
Right.
Because she believes that that world needs the grasshopper lays heavy, and for him to just snuff that out, she's not willing to accept. So she does the unthinkable, and after a short breakdown, does the unthinkable and, for lack of want of a better term, saves that world because of her actions. And I don't think she even consults the I Ching when she makes that decision. It's probably the one time in the book that she doesn't. And
yeah, that's kind of the moment of greatest agency of any of the characters in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about Togomi at some point after he's given the original artwork that's been made by Frank and Ed. Not artwork, but jewelry, right? He's looking to have some kind of profound experience, and he has this vision of what I assume is actually our world, but there's no reason to think it actually is, just because of it's Philip K. Dick, but it's another world that he at least views.
That part was interesting as well, because it talks about more about the Japanese spirituality as well, with the concept of the Wu.
Mm-hmm.
Which I must admit I'm pretty ignorant about, but it seems almost like the only sort of spiritual thing you really see in the book as well, because there's no, I think Juliana mentions church maybe once or twice, but there's no sort of, it's almost like the I Ching is their religion, for lack of one of a better term. Where sometimes, people would turn to the Bible or to the Quran or something and just consult that to say, well, what do I do in this situation, or read a bit and it resonates with what they're doing at that time. But, it just seems like he is the only one that has any sort of real spiritual connection, because it's after that that he seems – he's definitely changed by it. He seems a bit more willing to, because he shoots the agent in the jaw with the gun,
right,
and saves or attempts to save Baines from what's occurring as well.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem a very spiritual sort of society that they've got, but it just seems like Togomi seeks out, once he's had that experience, he wants more. He wants to explore it and see what it is, but. And it seems a society very bereft of that sort of experience.
Yep. Well, anything else that you want to talk about this book?
No, I found it an interesting read. I did find a audio book version up on archive.org if anyone's interested in listening to it rather than reading it. I'm interested to see how the TV show goes as an adaptation. And... I can sort of see why it won the Hugo when it did. It just seemed very thought-provoking, and not in a direct way, not as probably a more obvious way that a lot of other Hugo winners are.
Right.
But it was different enough that it definitely deserved to win that. And I think it was the only Philip K. Dick book that won the Hugo.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. It's, to me, I mean, kind of by way of final thoughts on this one, the point of the book, if I found one this time, was kind of going back to that quote from Wegener, that regardless of if there are better worlds out there, and in alternate universes, we're in this one. And our responsibility is to make good choices and to make things better, kind of one choice at a time. And I think that's a profound idea. It's kind of obvious, but I don't know. Sometimes we can get a little pie in the sky and go, if only it were this way, if only it were this way. Well, yeah, okay, but it is this way. So if we can change that, let's do that.
Well, that sort of ties right into that thing that I is it a poem that you guys have over there? The nail, was it? Because of the nail, the shoe was lost. Because of the horse being lost, the battle was lost. And because of right. the battle being lost, the war was lost, and all for the want of a nail.
Right.
We can contemplate that nail all we want, but it's not going to change the current circumstance. It's I thought that was really I think what Wagner almost experiences at the end is probably I would say an epiphany. So I would probably retract what I was saying before that there isn't very much spirituality in it, but I think it's usually at that moment of juncture where they don't consult I Ching that they basically have those moments of that Tagomi gets to see a glimpse of something good, and Wagner, going to his fate, knowing what's going to happen, accepts it and goes, well, this is what's happened. There's nothing I can do about it. But we can't sort of look backwards and wish that things were different, because things are different in this book and they're not any better. If anything, they're worse. So,
right.
And, you know, who knows if the reality of the grasshopper lies heavy. It seemed like a paradise to what the characters of the book said, but who was to say that in the reality of that book, that in 20 years' time from that it wasn't worse again anyway. So,
sure.
They can't sort of, if there was one takeaway from it is that basically you can contemplate your navel for so long and wonder what should have happened and what didn't happen, but at the end of the day, basically, it is here, it is now, and we all have the free will to sort of make our own choices and better choices, like you were saying, from that point out, and define what we want from life.
Yep. Well, Michael, I really want to thank you for doing this, for picking this book a long time ago and being patient with me while I slowly made my way back to you as I booked guest after guest that wasn't you.
No, it's all good. There was heaps of good content to listen to, and that was worth the wait.
Cool. All right. So any projects that you want to plug, anything you want to talk about?
I'm currently working on a blog at the moment called Literary Square Eyes, where I think I took a page from your book with James and Colin on Take Me to Your Reader, where you guys are doing adapted movies. I'm looking at TV shows. So I've been reading and watching Day of the Triffids. So that should be – I've just got to finish the book, but I've listened to the radio production and watched two TV versions of it. So hopefully that'll be up soon. And then things like Chocky and Minority Report, because it was a TV show. And,
right.
So
then you'll have to get around to The Man in High Castle at some point.
Yes, now that it's finishing, that's my biggest issue with the project at the moment is TV shows that seem to get a life of their own and go for multiple seasons. So I'm very thankful the Minority Report only lasted a season. So, that's what I'm working on. So, cool. If people want to reach me on the account for that, it's Literary Square Eyes on Instagram and Twitter. And the Twitter handle Books to TV Show. And I'll send you through the blog post on the email as well, Seth.
Yeah, sounds good. And I'll put all that information in the show notes so people can follow you there. And when you told me about that project, I was excited about it. So I'm excited about reading more stuff from you in the future. All right. Well, Michael, thanks again for doing this, and I'm sure that we'll interact on Twitter and over email and Facebook Messenger and all that stuff down the line. But it was really great to talk to you. Okay, bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.
And I think I just had one of those things that I think that you guys have probably had at some point during the 5 years. Looked up at the bookcase and I realized a point I wanted to discuss and I completely forgot about it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because I had, when I was thinking about it, I was out watering the front lawn, and I had a thought going, well, hang on, if this reality has changed in High Castle, that means that probably Dresden may not have gotten bombed as badly as what it did, which means that Kurt Vonnegut would have never written Slaughterhouse 5. And I just thought, and then I was looking, I was telling you about the blog, and then I'm looking across, and then I saw Slaughterhouse 5 in my bookcase, and I've just gone, totally forgot.
It's okay. I'm actually still recording on the backup machine, so I might drop this in as like a little post-credits blooper.
Okay, cool.
No, yeah, I could totally see where you're going with that. That's an interesting idea.